Welcome to the Talking Legal Ed podcast with Professors Linda Jellum and Billy Jo Kaufman. In each episode, we explore cutting-edge legal issues with renowned legal scholars and teachers. In these explorations, we discuss the legal doctrines implicated in the issues we tackle, but perhaps more importantly, we look at how legal educators can bring these issues alive in the classroom.
Okay, Billy Jo, well, I'm very excited that we have Steve Vladek from the University of Texas on today. He's going to talk to us about what the shadow docket is, the substance, volume, and precedent of the Supreme Court's shadow docket, and then also give us advice on how to be yourself in the classroom, but help the students see who that self is.
You know, Linda, this is going to be terrific. I worked with Steve for a number of years, and I can't imagine that it's not going to be fun, educational, and informative.
Well, great. Steve, welcome to Talking Legal Ed. Thank you so much for being here with us on your anniversary, no less. We're so thrilled to start our second season with you. You've just been all over the news, all over the airs, talking about the shadow docket. Could you briefly describe what the shadow docket is for our listeners?
Sure. I mean, the term was coined, at least in the context of the U.S. Supreme Court, by Will Bode at the University of Chicago in 2015. And Will coined the term basically to describe everything the Supreme Court does besides the big fancy merits cases that it decides each year. It wasn't meant as a pejorative. I think Will meant it as a sort of term to reflect the inscrutability and obscurity of most of these rulings. But, you know, these are orders for the most part. These are often anodyne orders, granting more time to file a brief, allowing a party to participate in the argument. What Will was reacting to, though, is a phenomenon that's only accelerated since he wrote the paper that coined the term, which is the seeming impression that the Supreme Court was doing more and more significant and, to my mind, more and more substantive work through these orders, orders that are traditionally unsigned, unexplained, and handed down at all times of day or even night. And since Will wrote that in 2015, that's really exploded, where, you know, we see far more of these today than we've ever seen before. It's not just quantity. We're seeing the Supreme Court, through orders, affect far more people. So, you know, orders that are blocking state COVID policies, orders that are staying district court injunctions of federal immigration policies, orders that are, you know, clearing the way for particular election reforms or blocking election reforms. And I think the sort of the phenomenon I've been interested in is how, while all this is happening, while the court is doing more of these, and while the court is doing these in a way that's affecting more and more people, it's also treating at least some of these orders as precedential in ways that it never has before, yelling at lower courts, the Ninth Circuit in particular, sometimes for not following unsigned orders in prior cases. And I guess, Linda, to me, it's the confluence of all of those things that really make this not just a worthwhile topic, something that we should be educating ourselves and the public about, but also an alarming one. You know, as someone who thinks that a big part of the Supreme Court's legitimacy comes from its ability to offer principled explanations for its decisions, you know, the more that the court is deciding major issues and is affecting all of our lives without providing those principled explanations, I think the more that that calls into pretty serious question, right, the court's role as an institution. So long answer, but that's sort of what it is and why I think it's become such a thing in the last couple of years.
So if I could just briefly summarize, it sounds like the docket, the shadow docket as it's been named, has gone on for a very long time because things like giving people additional time to submit their briefs or maybe to provide orders or whatever, that fairly procedural minor things. But what's happened since 2015 and more so sort of past 2015 is that we've seen an explosion, one might say, in the substance of these orders, in the ability of the court not only to start issuing important topics, but also to expect the lower courts to start following these shadow docket orders. Just a quick question, where's the authority for the Supreme Court to issue orders through the shadow docket?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think it's substance, it's volume, and it's precedent, right? It's those three things. As for authority, it depends on what kind of order it is. I mean, so if it's an order respecting certiorari, then that obviously comes from the cert statutes, 1254 for the lower federal courts, 1257 for state courts. 28 U.S.C. Section 2101F specifically gives the Supreme Court or the justices thereof the power to issue stays of lower court decisions. I don't think it's a stretch to read into that statute the power to vacate lower court stays. And the power to issue injunctions, the most extreme form of emergency relief, is actually not expressly provided by any statute. The Supreme Court has long derived it from the All Writs Act, 28 U.S.C. Section 1651, which is relevant at least in part because it's a really high bar insofar as it comes from that statute. And one of the things that we've seen, Linda, especially over the last 12 months, is a rise in that particular form of emergency relief, where, you know, for the first 15 years of the Roberts Court, I think my count is something like there were four emergency injunctions pending appeal, injunctions of state or federal actors when two layers of lower courts had refused to block the policy while the litigation unfolded. Four in 15 years until last November. And in the last year, there have been seven. You know, four of them over three public dissents, three of them over four. And I think that's both, I think, testament to the phenomenon that I'm reacting to, and part of the problem, which is that the more the court does it, the more the court's going to do it. And I think that's part of why, you know, whether you have trouble with what the court's doing or not doing on the shadow docket, no one can deny anymore that it's a really important part of the court's work, that, you know, those of us who are trying to provide holistic overviews of the court, who are trying to explain the work of the court to our students, to the public, neglect whatever we're calling this chunk of work, the shadow docket, the emergency docket, the banana docket, we neglect it at our peril.
So to say that you look and talk passionately about this subject would be an understatement. And of course, you're very widely spoken out in the public. What got you so interested in this particular topic?
Well, you know, I mean, you guys have known me since I was a baby law professor. I've always been attracted to esoteria. I guess I've always been struck, and this is maybe the Fed Court's nerd in me, by the more technical parts of the Supreme Court's docket, right? So, you know, the one example is the Supreme Court has this mostly moribund power to issue what are called original writs of habeas corpus, which actually in federal courts doctrine is a pretty important backstop and residuum of authority that the court has in truly exceptional cases that, mind you, it hasn't used since 1925. Like, I've been drawn to that as both interesting historical lessons about the court and for the role they play in broader understandings of jurisdiction stripping and of the relationship between Congress and the Supreme Court. And so I don't think it was much of a surprise that when this really started to pick up, when the emergency applications piece of this story really started to ratchet up in the summer of 2017, I was drawn to it. And I was drawn to it as a court watcher. I was drawn to it as a federal courts professor. And I was drawn to it as, you know, a CNN analyst whose job is to explain to the reporters and producers at CNN what this stuff is. And, you know, we got June 2017, when the Supreme Court ruled on what was then travel ban, 1.0, you know, that was a shadow docket ruling. And I think the summer it provoked with regard to the stay, the partial stays the Supreme Court issued, really was the opening of the floodgates for me.
Well, Steve, this takes me to that obvious question. As an academic who deals in this in a different way in the academy, how do you think it differs from the media or historians or other people that are looking at this at the same time?
Yeah, you know, Billie Jo, it's a great question. I guess, you know, I never feel like I take any of my hats off. And so, you know, when the Supreme Court issues like a new significant shadow docket ruling, I'm interested in it for different reasons, right? That there's sort of the academic part of it, which is, you know, cataloging this ruling as part of a broader data set, trying to figure out if there are any broader themes that the ruling is part of. There's the sort of like public, you know, debate piece of it, which is describing for people, like, you know, turning this legalese into accessible prose. And then there's the classroom part of it, which is, you know, to what extent does this new development prompt me to either tell my current students, right, even if it's not part of our class, or in those classes where this stuff is relevant, right, tweak my syllabus. And this is going to sound sort of trite, but I feel like, you know, I'm not having those conversations one at a time. Like it's, you know, you sort of process these things in real time and try to figure out how they're relevant across all of the axes of your, you know, professional existence. And I guess part of why I find the shadow docket so fascinating and also so fatiguing is because it is evolving a lot on the fly in ways that affect every one of those buckets, right? In ways that affect how I teach this material, in ways that affect, you know, sort of broader scholarship about this material, in ways that affect public debate about this material. And that's both, I think, exhilarating and exhausting. I don't think, Billy Joe, I was expecting when I started writing about this in, 2018, that 3 years later, it would have only ratcheted up, you know, exponentially since I, you know, from inception.
So, Steve, it sounds like this topic has become sort of maybe the centerpiece of your current scholarship anyway. I'd like to ask you a question about your CNN analyst gig, so to speak. how did you get involved in that? And, you know, for like a law professor that might want to do something like that, first of all, would you recommend it or not? But, you know, tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll move into a discussion of the in the classroom stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit fortuitous, Linda. You know, as you guys know, before I came to UT, I was at American University, where I was, I had the honor of being Billy Joe's colleague. And when you're in DC, there are a lot of things that sort of, there are a lot of opportunities that are available to you as a law professor, or I think really as any kind of academic in DC, just by dint of being in DC, right? You're close, you're convenient, whether or not you're competent. And I guess, you know, there was, folks might remember that when the big Obamacare decision came down in 2012, CNN's coverage of it was not, shall we say, perfect, right? You know, CNN was on air for a few minutes talking about how the court had struck down the Affordable Care Act when, of course, it didn't. And I think it was right around then that folks at the network made the decision that they wanted to have a full-time, you know, Supreme Court analyst. And I had worked with them a couple times before. I was local, which meant that if they needed me, I could pop by the studio. And so we, you know, the first year we did it, it was just for like a handful of pre-selected big decision days. And the role just has sort of evolved and expanded as time goes on to the point where, you know, it's usually a couple times a week now, right, that I'm talking to folks at the network about Supreme Court stuff. So I guess if there's a lesson there, right, it's that, you know, fortuity matters, right, that networks matter, contacts matter. And I guess, you know, as for whether I'd recommend it, I mean, I think it's a question of how we all create our priorities. I enjoy it because I like the challenge of taking complex legalese and trying to make it accessible to large public audiences. I think that actually makes us better teachers in the classroom if we're doing it outside of the classroom as well. But it's not for everyone. It's a lot of work. And depending upon your particular work modes, it might even be a greatly disproportionate amount of work for, you know, how much you get paid and what professional value it adds. You know, I think it's just like, it's just, I think it's one of those things where if you're interested in checking out media, you know, build out slowly, right? You know, develop more relationships with reporters, be more accessible and available. Maybe start with your local news folks in the city in which you're teaching and, you know, build relationships there because it can get to be overwhelming. And I think the key for all of us, right, is not overcommitting to a point where we're shirking what by any account are our, you know, more important professional responsibilities.
We'd be remiss, I guess, if we didn't move on and talk about the Supreme Court's decision via the shadow docket to deny whether to grant an injunction in the Texas new abortion law. I guess that's S8 or something close to that. You teach constitutional law to students in Texas. How do you address that in class?
You know, this was, Billy Joe, a really tough one. I am usually very, very committed to talking about current events in the classroom. I think it is helpful for students. I think it can be pedagogically valuable to tie what might be more esoteric or inaccessible topics to things they're seeing in front of them. I think for a lot of them, it's picking up on curiosities they might not be comfortable publicly expressing. And so my default rule is if something interesting happens that's relevant to a class I'm teaching, I talk about it. But first year, first semester, first week of law school is a little different. And all the SB8 stuff dropped what was for us like the second day of con law. And I was really on the fence about what to do, because it's, you know, my experience, I'm curious if you guys had the same, those first couple of classes are so important in cultivating the relationship you want between you and your students, in creating the dynamic that you want to create in the classroom. Like, there's stuff you'll be able to get away with later in a semester that you won't be able to get away with on day one. And so it was actually like, I agonized over whether to talk about SB8 and whether to actually help my 1Ls, you know, first week of law school, understand what the heck was going on with this controversial law that was in this crazy procedural posture in the Supreme Court. And Billy Joe, I decided at the end of the day that I had to do it. And that I had to do it for the students who wanted to talk about it but weren't comfortable asking. Right? The assumption that I had students in the classroom for whom what was going on with SB8 was deeply personal and not just, you know, interesting and political. And that to sort of not confront the elephant in the room was not neutral. There was actually, you know, it was implicitly taking a position that I did not mean to take. And so I spent time the second day of my class introducing SB8, carefully laying out what the bill does, situating it against the backdrop of the Supreme Court's abortion jurisprudence, which I told them we'd get to later in the semester. The old law professor Dodge, you know, we'll come back to this later in the semester, assuming that no one ever checks to see if you do. But I also, I mean, more so than I think I ever have in my career, I really went off on the procedural traps that SB8 creates. And I tried to make sure my students understood what the procedural traps were. And I tried to sort of point out that whatever you think of abortion, you know, if a state legislature can do this to constitutional rights, those rights aren't worth very much. And, you know, it was the second day of class, so I got no useful feedback because the students didn't know me that well yet. But we'll see, I very well might end up paying a price for that on the evaluations. You know, that was sort of a very conscious balancing I did when I decided to do it. But you know what, guys, I don't regret it, right? Like if the worst thing that comes out of that is that my evaluations are a little more negative this semester than is typical for a 1L con law class, I can live with that.
You know, Steve, as you were talking, I'm currently visiting this year, and I was wondering why I'm feeling more relaxed at this point in the semester than I was in the first few days of classes, and you nailed it. And I didn't realize that's what it is. It takes an extra amount of work, really, to go in the classroom those first few days and establish that rapport. And I think for our audience, the law professors in our audience, to recognize that there is just a different level of energy and work, really, that you have to bring to the classroom. So here you are, you walk in, you have this, you know, major decision. So I'm teaching tax, right? Things aren't quite so exciting, but there's been a lot going on this semester. And I usually have an in the news story is the first thing we do. And we talk about what's going on tax-wise in the news, which I'm sure would excite everyone that's listening. But it's a little bit easier. I'm teaching an upper level class. I've been a law professor for way too many years. You're walking into your class, you know, first, second, third year of teaching. You going to make the same choice?
I mean, I did. So, you know, before I was at American, I spent my first 2 years at the University of Miami. And the spring of my first year, the union that all the custodial workers at the University of Miami went on strike as part of a protracted labor dispute. And there were a number of us on the faculty who refused to cross the picket line. And, you know, I wish that we lived in a world where that was not perceived as an overtly political move by a faculty member, but we don't. And here I was, like a brand new 25-year-old assistant professor of law in my second semester teaching. And I was teaching second semester 1Ls in con law. And, you know, I wouldn't cross the picket line. So we met off campus. And I sent my students a series of emails explaining why I had made the decisions I had made. I invited them to raise concerns with me, either publicly or privately. I blogged about it because those were the days. And, you know, and Linda, I think I would do it again. But, you know, I also have to recognize that even as a first year professor, I was coming from a position of enormous privilege, right? I was a white male, right? I was a white male who had, you know, fairly, I think, well-entrenched academic credentials at that point, right? I had written a whole lot, like I had I wasn't sort of an empty slate, a blank slate. And I had faith that my faculty colleagues supported me. And so I felt like, you know, whatever the public backlash might have been, whatever the backlash might have been in the classroom, I'd get over it. And I got some pretty, you know, I think skeptical evaluations that semester. But, you know, to my students' credit, at least that semester, the evaluations were very careful to separate out their agreement or disagreement with the crossing the picket line piece of it from their substantive assessment of the class. And I think the lesson I took away from that, and I think this is a really important and valuable thing, is how critical it is that we always be as transparent with our students as possible. That we explain, when we're making decisions that are going to affect the entire class, where there might be reasonable points of opposition, and where there might be sort of, convincing competing arguments. Like, just, you know, you don't have to be right as the professor, but I think there's so much value in helping the students see your thought process and in explaining to the students why you've made the decision you chose to make. And that's been my mantra ever since, is that, like, if I'm going to introduce topics that I think are going to potentially risk blowback, right? So be it, but I'm going to go in like telling the students why I'm doing it and not just that I'm doing it. And, you know, I don't know that that's always going to work, but I think it's at least helped me insulate myself a bit, right, from some of the blowback it might have otherwise provoked.
So your discussion, and it was a very brave step, I think, that I think a lot of first year faculty might be very concerned with doing, but you know, Eric Siegel, I know. And the discussion that you're having with us now reminds me very much of our discussion that we had with Eric in our last show, where Eric, you know, Eric's kind of out there and in your face about some of his opinions in a good way. But what he sort of ended with was the most important thing he could recommend in the classroom is to be genuine and be who you are. And that seems to be what I'm hearing you say right now, is that that just is who you were and you really couldn't do anything different, even if you had wanted to almost.
Yeah, I mean, my former colleague David Abraham likes to quote Martin Luther, "Here I stand, I can do no other." And, you know, that resonates. I mean, we are where we are because of who we are. And, you know, not all of us have personalities, every feature of which is conducive to being an effective classroom teacher. But I think the more we try to suppress our personalities, you know, the more the students can smell it. And I, you know, it has always been my experience that you are so much better off being yourself and helping the students see who you are than being who you think the students want you to be and not letting them in. And, you know, I can't say that that's worked, Linda, 100% successfully. I've had students across the years who have been, you know, frustrated by my outness of my views, right, by my sort of willingness to be quite clear on what my particular opinions are in my classes. And I guess I just, you know, I think that's the trade-off. And it's a trade-off that we all have to make. But what I've seen from friends and colleagues is that those of us who try to put on a different face in the classroom fail, right? You know, we fail in the sense that we're either unable to do it genuinely, or the students just see through it, or we end up suppressing those parts of our personalities, right, that are actually responsible for our success. And so I just, you know, I think it is so important to be yourself, not to be yourself in the classroom, but also to help the students see who that is. And so I often, back to the point about cultivating the rapport and the dynamic from the beginning of class, you know, I often send lengthy emails to my students before we've ever even met, just to try to sort of tell them a bit about myself, but also start getting them to buy in to the notion that we're all in this together. And this term was a really good example of that. Even before SB8, you know, I'm teaching at a major public university where I'm not allowed to require masks. I'm not allowed to ask if my students are vaccinated. I'm not even allowed to ask them to wear masks. And I sent my students a long email right before classes started that was basically like, here's why I will be wearing a mask. And here's why I think, you know, having respect for those around you in your community is an important value. But you need to make your own decision, right? And I think, you know, that's, whether it's about masks or teaching controversial topics or crossing picket lines or what have you, you know, now more than ever, it's incumbent upon us to be who we are in the classroom and not to be who we think the students want us to be.
Well, Steve, clearly you are who you are. And when we were both at AU, kind of the one great thing, it was a small, private, well-located in DC, but pretty nationally known as a pretty liberal place. I think Austin might be pretty liberal, but tell us how that transition and move to UT, a T14 school, to a law professor they clearly recruited and wanted. So,
yeah, I mean, Billy Joe, it's certainly different to be a law professor at a public school in a state, the dominant politics of which are not your own, than in a private school anywhere. You know, I think where that really shows up perhaps the most actually is, you know, our student body is ideologically diverse to a far greater degree than the student bodies were at either Miami or American, which of course I think only ratchets up the potential flashpoints when someone like me is so, I think, transparent about my views and my opinions in the classroom. I do think that there are additional thought processes that enter into play when you teach at a public school, right? Not necessarily so much because you're worried about you being punished directly. I mean, I think at least where we are today, principles of academic freedom are still fairly robust within the legal academy. I actually wouldn't be so concerned about that. But you also don't want to sort of unnecessarily get your school into trouble. And yeah, that's an issue for public schools, I think, to a degree that it wasn't and isn't for private schools. And so, you know, I don't moderate my comments for that reason. I could have just ended that sentence as I don't moderate my comments, right? But I do think about, you know, sort of when I'm speaking out publicly on things, I am a little bit sort of, you know, careful to not sort of gratuitously say things that get the law school in trouble. Because, you know, we are lucky to be in a, even though we are in a very, a red state with a very conservative state government structure, the law school is not, I think, singled out for maltreatment by the powers that be on partisan political grounds. And it would be a terrible thing to sort of provoke that. So, you know, this is where I think also deans come into play, because, you know, one of the many, many things I admire about my current dean, Ward Farnsworth, is that Ward has never said a word to me crosswise, right, about being on Twitter, about criticizing Governor Abbott on Twitter, about fighting with both of our senators on Twitter. And I think it's because, you know, one, first of all, I try to keep the conversation respectful. You know, we can disagree without being disagreeable. But two, I also think, you know, it is really important to model even sort of heated disagreement as an academic enterprise, as opposed to sort of silent acquiescence. And I say that as someone who is tenured and chaired, and so, you know, has about as much job security as anyone this side of a Supreme Court justice. But I like to think that we cultivate that even among our untenured faculty. And, you know, the difference, Billy Joe, is that I think about it now in a way that I didn't before. And it probably affects my conduct at the margins. But if anything, it also makes me feel like it's more important for me to speak out now than I ever felt when I was on the faculty at American.
Well, while we've been on the air, Steve Bannon has been indicted by a federal grand jury. So you'll have things to speak about on CNN and maybe in class come Monday. Linda, do you have any closing remarks?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, Steve, your advice about someone moving from a small private school to a public school in a very red state is going to affect me directly. I will be making a move next fall, going to Idaho and working with the University of Idaho, which I'm excited about, and also now a little nervous. Thank you very much. So I just wanted to say thank you so much for your time. I particularly enjoyed your comments about the teaching in the classroom, which I can summarize as be yourself, but help the students see who that is. And I think that's a wonderful way to think about it, along with Eric's idea of being genuine. I want to thank you, Billy Joe, and I both want to thank you for being on today with us on your anniversary. When I knew you, when you weren't even married, let alone had two children, it's just crazy how fast time goes. But maybe we can have you on again sometime and talk about your Twitter. I mean, you have taken Twitter to a new level and almost made it a new form of scholarship. And I think there's an awful lot that we can learn and talk about on another show the next time.
How to waste time on social media, colon.
There you go. Wonderful. Well, wonderful.
My best to Karen and the girls.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Steve.
That was a great conversation, Linda. Hope everybody joins us next time for Talking Legal Ed.
Talking Legal Ed is produced by David Ritchie in association with Panopticon Media. Editing by Tim Spieshock and artwork by Kaylee Jellum. Please look for all our episodes wherever you find your podcasts.